June, can you type? Oh, yes, I typed all of Charlie's papers at Princeton. Do you need lessons? Desperately. Could you teach me? We'd be so grateful. Sam's head was pounding now, and he wished June would stop squealing. I'd be delighted to help. And was smiling broadly and gave Sam a look that he couldn't interpret. Was she gloating? Proud to be able to help a simple girl like June? When do you need to learn by? She asked. Next week? Then we should start immediately. I could come back after dinner. Nonsense, stay here for dinner. There's plenty for both of you. Sam felt trapped. There was no way out of this. He took off his hat and hung it by the door.
Thanks, Anne, he said. It's really swell of you to help out.
It wasn't long before Charlie was home, and Anne served them beef hash and potatoes. She was so kind and pleasant throughout the meal that Sam found it hard to maintain his anger, though he wanted to. She seemed to take a special interest in June, and they chatted and laughed about feminine matters like lipsticks and skirt length. Charlie grinned at Sam, rolling his eyes at the women in his good-natured way. After dinner, Anne got out the typewriter and began teaching June how to use it at the dining room table. Charlie and Sam went to the living room for a game of chess. The sound of female voices combined with the typewriter's rat-a-tat-tat made Sam feel like he was in a secretarial school. The next day, he came home to find June already there, practicing as Anne knitted beside her. And so it went the whole week. June and he shared dinner with Charlie and Anne, and June spent every free moment pounding on the typewriter. By the weekend, he was carrying on conversations with Anne again and realized that without either one of them saying anything, they had made up. June was gaining confidence with her typing, and Anne said she was getting the hang of it. Sam had found out as much as he could from Dr. Armstrong's secretary about what June could expect at her interview on Monday. One thing he hadn't counted on was a lie detector test. It struck him as ridiculous for a secretary, especially since the machines were notoriously unreliable. But June panicked again when he told her about it. But I'll have to lie when they ask me what I know about Y-12. She was sitting at the typewriter. It was Saturday afternoon, and Charlie and Anne had gone out to the movies, so they had the house to themselves. He had been hoping to get June into bed, but so far hadn't managed to pull her away from the typewriter. He saw now that mentioning the lie detector had been a tactical error.
There's no need to worry. The machine can't really tell if you're lying. It just measures your blood pressure and pulse. If you remain calm when they ask you questions, it should be fine.
June's eyes were wide, and Sam was afraid her blood pressure was spiking right now.
Let's practice, he said,
dragging his chair beside her. He put his hand gently on the nape of her neck and felt the thumping of her heart.
Is your name June Walker?
She giggled. Yes.
How long have you worked at the Clinton Engineer Works?
5 months.
Have you ever spoken with anyone about the nature of your work?
No.
Her heartbeat seemed steady to him, though it was difficult to tell.
Have you ever had sexual relations with any of your superiors at the CEW?
Her heart sped up for sure that time. She looked him in the eye with a mischievous grin. No. He kissed her, and a couple of minutes later managed to get her away from the typewriter after all. June was allowed a day off from work for her interview. She woke up before her alarm had a chance to ring and went down to the bathroom to wash and take the curlers out of her hair. She had made sure her best dress, red with white buttons, was clean and pressed and had bought a smart jacket at the department store in town to go with it. Mrs. Ransom's lecture from her first day at Oak Ridge rang in her ears as she applied eyeliner and a touch of rouge borrowed from Cece. Look attractive, but not too attractive. Cece was on the night shift and still in bed. June was glad she didn't have to talk to her this morning. She'd told her a couple of days before about the interview and could tell Cece didn't like it. June couldn't really blame her. It wasn't fair, and she felt guilty to have this opportunity just because of her man. On the other hand, if anyone should understand, shouldn't it be Cece? She, who so blatantly hunted for a rich husband and showed off Tom's presents? June dropped by the cafeteria for breakfast, but ordered only one slice of toast to dull her hunger pangs. She knew she should eat something, but was afraid anything more would make her ill. Her stomach seemed to have a mind of its own, and she was glad the lie detector couldn't measure her level of nausea, which would surely give her away. She practiced typing even as she ate, thinking of a word such as toast and moving the correct fingers to pretend type it in the air. Her fingers moved fast, and she no longer had to think consciously about where the keys were. In fact, she liked typing. It was basically as mindless as the work in her cubicle, but she enjoyed racing with herself to go faster and faster. The satisfaction of the clack, 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 and the finished product of bold, black-on-white words. She reported to the bullpen, where she'd spent her first few days in Oak Ridge. Back in November, this plain, rectangular office building had seemed daunting. She'd been so unsure of where to go or what would happen to her. She knew Oak Ridge so well now, it was difficult to imagine ever having been so intimidated by this place. It truly felt like home. The receptionist gave her a pile of forms to fill out. The woman moved with assurance and spoke with a bright smile. June watched her enviously and hoped that soon she, too, could be an administrator. The working women in the movies she watched at the Ridge Theater seemed to live glamorous lives. It was usually just a matter of time before their bosses seduced them, but this, of course, wouldn't be a worry for June because Sam would be her boss. She wanted to smile for visitors, answer phones with a syrupy voice, tell people to wait one moment, and take exquisite messages. Besides, it was a career that could take her beyond Y-12 and the war, which was surely winding to a close. Yesterday, Hitler had killed himself, and now all anyone was talking about was when the Germans would surrender. The papers were filled with news of triumph, yet there were more horrors still. The Americans and Russians had found vast camps where human beings had been made to live like animals, and then were slaughtered like animals as well. The horror of it could hardly be contained in a newsreel. Pictures showed American soldiers giving food to starving men and women who looked more dead than alive, their bones visible through their taut, sickly skin. These images stayed with June. Every time she thought she had a handle on, at least an understanding of, this war, she realized she had no idea. She would never have any idea, really, save here in Tennessee. In future years, on occasions when she had encounters with veterans and a handful of Europe's displaced persons, she would always know that they had seen sights she would never be able to imagine, and had known things about people she couldn't begin to understand. Attending dinner parties populated with the wounded men of her generation, or chatting with the shy foreign woman who worked in the market, June would remain horrified and humbled by the suffering she knew was beyond comprehension. Another woman came out to tell June her typing test was about to commence. A big green typewriter waited for her on a desk. Beside it was a document holder with the letter she was to type and a stack of paper. June breathed deeply, sat down, and loaded the paper into the machine. "Ready?" asked the woman. "Yes, ma'am." "All right. Start." She got off to a flying start, a sprinter bursting off the starting block. Then she ground to a halt as she watched herself type HTE twice in one sentence. Her heart was beating faster than she was typing, but she forced herself to concentrate, go slower, more carefully. Gradually, she built up speed once again. Clack, clack, clack went the keys, and she was back in control, her fingers bounding around the keyboard. In a flash, the 5 minutes were over. She had filled up just over half the page, single-spaced. Next, she had an interview with Sam and someone called Sergeant Johnson. Once she got in the job, it wouldn't matter if people knew they were going together, but Sam thought it would hurt her chances of being hired if the Army thought he'd requested her only because he found her attractive. She had to pretend that she and Sam were just casual acquaintances, which was nerve-wracking. Even so, with the typing test over, she felt relaxed. She shook hands with Sergeant Johnson and Sam and took a seat across from them at a small round table. Sergeant Johnson's demeanor was friendly. "Nice to meet you, June," he said, shuffling through the form she'd filled out earlier. "Miss Andrews tells us you did well just now on the typing test," he continued and looked up. "Know what you scored?" She shook her head. 68 words per minute, with 2 errors. That's very good. Where did you learn to type?"
"I took a course in Knoxville a couple of years back." This was the lie that Sam had come up with, and they'd practiced again and again.
She kept focused on Sergeant Johnson to avoid Sam's eyes.
"Why didn't you apply for a secretarial job here?"
"Well, sir, I never actually finished that course. I didn't know if I'd be qualified."
"Oh, well, with this typing speed, you should be fine. Now, I think Dr. Cantor has a few questions for you."
Sam nodded and took out a legal pad on which he'd scribbled his questions. Of course, she'd already seen them and practiced answering them with him the night before.
He spoke in an authoritative voice, and his stare was cold. Later, they would kiss and cuddle and laugh about it all. The rest of the interview went smoothly, and Sergeant Johnson didn't seem to suspect a thing. Finally, it was time for the lie detector test. Miss Andrews led her down a hall to another small room. A large black box sat on a table, wires and cables coming out of it in different directions. June repeated in her mind, "Don't be scared. You're in control," as Sam had suggested to her. It felt silly, but it did seem to calm her. A man in a lab coat told her to take a seat.
"Please don't be nervous, June. You understand, because of the sensitive nature of this job, all potential employees have to undergo a polygraph test."
"Yes." He explained that he had to attach the polygraph components to her, but it would be totally painless. She nodded, and he asked her to untuck her blouse and unbutton it slightly at the top. He took two of the tubes connected to the machine and attached one to her chest and one to her stomach, just above her skirt, with sticky patches that tugged at her skin. Next, he attached small metal plates to the index and ring fingers of her left hand. Then he asked her to roll up her sleeve and placed a blood pressure cuff around her upper arm.
"Is your name June Walker?"
"Yes."
"Where are you from?"
"Blount County, Tennessee."
"What is your mother's name?"
"Rose."
"Have you ever lied to her?"
June was startled by this and wondered if the machine could tell. "Yes," she said.
"What did you have for supper last night?"
Again, June faltered. She realized she was getting more and more nervous. She couldn't remember. Anne had cooked, but what had it been? "Chicken stew," she said over-triumphantly, relieved to have remembered. After that, she managed to keep calm. "Don't be scared. Don't be scared," she kept telling herself. The test went on for over an hour, more mundane questions, then on to the serious ones.
"Have you ever discussed with anyone outside of your job what you do here at Oak Ridge?"
"No." "You're in control," she thought. "Don't be scared."
"Have you ever witnessed another employee revealing classified information?"
"No." Finally, it was done. He helped her out of the tubes and told her she was free to go. As she stood, she glanced at the machine and the chart of lines created by her responses. She didn't know if they were good or bad. Sam had lunch with Sergeant Johnson, a good guy who said he didn't see any problems with hiring the girl as long as she passed the security test. When they got back to the bullpen, Johnson's secretary told them that Mr. Geary, the polygraph administrator, was ready to see them.
"The girl looks perfect from a security perspective.
Sweet little country thing, as far as I can tell."
The polygraph man lit up a cigarette and offered his pack to the other men. Sam took one, feeling celebratory.
"Just between us, the lie detector test's a joke. Miss Walker passed all the security questions, but failed when I asked if she knew how to type."
Sam laughed just a bit too loudly at that, his anxiety released all at once and replaced with a rush of sweet relief. It was only June's second week at her job when the news that everyone had been waiting for finally came in. She'd just arrived at the office and was feeding paper into the typewriter on her big wooden desk when the phone rang.
"Dr. Candor's office," she answered.
"Hello there," said a woman's voice. "I'm calling from the central office to let everyone know that victory has been declared in Europe." Even though she'd been waiting for it for weeks, it still came as a shock. "Please give everyone in your area the news, but also stress to them that they must keep working. No one is allowed to leave their post. Remind them that the war is not over and we still have a vital job to perform here."
"Of course."
She hung up and went to Sam's office. He was smoking by his window, looking down at the parking lot, and had obviously already heard. A large truck was driving through the parking lot, and a man was shouting the news through a megaphone out the window.
"Victory declared in Europe. Germany surrenders. Please do not leave your posts. We still have to fight a war with Japan. Whose son will die in the last minute?"
Sam turned to her.
"We got the Germans," he said,
his voice and face oddly blank, reflecting none of her own jubilation. Later, when trying to understand his reaction, June would think of only one explanation. Already he was thinking past the victory to the consequences of their work. There was no longer a race with Germany for a bomb. Whatever they were building would be destined for Japan. Chapter 16
Joe pushed his mop down a long hallway, whistling softly under his breath. This section of the building was all offices, and most folks had left for the day. It was quiet, save for an electric hum in the background, and the hallway was dark and stuffy. Cleaning the offices was easy work, and just a bit of sweeping, usually. The laboratories were a different story, and the toilets were the worst. But none of it was the strain that construction had been. This was Joe's third summer in Oak Ridge, and the Hutmans never had gotten any cooler or the mosquitoes any less vicious. But now that he had Mariah and his babies with him, it seemed more bearable. Between the two of them, they were making more money in a year than they would have seen in three in Alabama. The children were starting school in the fall and would be able to attend full days for the entire school year, unlike back in Alabama. They had moved into their own Hutman, still a wretched place to live, but his and Mariah's all the same, all to themselves and the children. It was a kind of bliss to come home after his late shifts and find her there, half asleep in the bed, waiting for him. And then in the morning to wake to the smell of bacon frying on the stove and see Mariah standing over the frying pan, little Ben at her feet. Nevertheless, he worried about the girls, especially Ellie. This was hardly a respectable place to bring up children, and they might be better off back on the farm, away from the gambling and violence of the Hutman area. Ellie was almost 13 now, old enough to get into trouble with all these rowdy men. The thought of it twisted Joe's guts. Luckily, she was tall but quite skinny, and still gawky in a girlish way that he hoped wouldn't give anyone any ideas. After their talk, the foreman had written a note to the officials at Roan Anderson and arranged for Mariah to come work as a cook in one of the cafeterias. Joe had taken the bus to Knoxville to meet her and the children. He'd gotten to the Greyhound station 2 hours early because he wanted to be sure to be waiting when they arrived. He bought 3 cups of coffee, drinking them slowly on a hard wooden bench by the window of the colored waiting area. Buses came and went. He watched tearful farewells, soldiers getting hugged and kissed hello, and travelers who had no one to say goodbye or hello to. He saw Becky first, hopping down the steps at the front of the bus in a pink dress and pigtails. Joe ran outside, waving, his coffee forgotten on the bench. By the time he got to Becky, Ellie was beside her, and Mariah was carefully climbing down the stairs, holding Ben, already 3 years old. Mariah's face was as familiar as his own reflection, and yet a miraculous surprise. She plopped Ben onto the ground and held out her arms. He embraced her, squeezing right through her flimsy cotton jacket, pressing his hand against the felt hat crowning the back of her head. "Mariah," he whispered. "I'm here," she said. "I'm here." He could feel the contours of her body against him, just as he remembered them. He didn't want to let go, but knew the girls were staring up at them, anxious. They were bashful, at first. Ellie was almost as tall as Mariah now, a skinny thing, all legs and big, wide eyes. Becky was softer, still insulated in baby fat, not quite a young woman yet, thank goodness. He said their names, Becky, Ellie, and they forgot their shyness and attacked from both sides, hugging his waist and legs. He kissed both their heads, then scooped up Ben and stared into his son's eyes. The child stared at him suspiciously, and it hurt Joe to know that he must not remember his daddy at all. Joe blew air onto Ben's cheek, an old trick that he remembered amused the girls when they were little, and the boy laughed. The army had begun allowing colored families to live together only a month earlier, finally caving in to the demands from the colored camp council. Negro families could apply for their own hutments now, and a small school for colored children had been set up. Even so, Ralph and his friends weren't content. Joe thought they might quit while they were ahead, but they continued meeting once a week, and Ralph had even gone to a labor meeting on the other side of town, too. There was no talking him out of it. Joe was certain Ralph would get laid off, but so far he hadn't been. Even this didn't make Ralph happy. He said it was because the bosses thought it would look bad to fire him after he'd made all that fuss. Joe couldn't see what difference it made. A paycheck was a paycheck. The folks knew who Ralph was now, and other men looked up to him, even with his crippled arm. Still, he was hardly more than a boy. His cheeks remained childishly plump, his eyes clear and hopeful. Joe felt bad having to leave him on his own in the Hutman while he moved to the family area with Mariah. Ralph was awfully quiet that day as Joe packed up his stuff.
He'd been sitting on his cot, watching Joe gather what few possessions he had. Finally, when Joe was snapping his footlocker shut, Ralph muttered almost under his breath, "You remember Alabama?" A silly question. Joe had lived there for 45 years, hadn't he?
Yeah.
When I first got to the farm, I didn't know nobody.
You look like something the cat drug in.
I reckon I did. But you and Mariah were real friendly to me. Joe put down the locker and turned to him.
You weren't no more than a boy.
Even so, you're always welcome in our house. Ralph had nodded without looking at Joe, embarrassed by the emotion in his voice. Mariah suggested inviting him and Shirley over for supper once they had their Hutman set up. It was her day off from cooking in the cafeteria, but nevertheless, she spent hours over her own wood stove trying to make a nice stew out of scraps from the cafeteria. The girls were tasked with keeping the Hutman neat. It was all but impossible to keep dirt out, but they dutifully swept and dusted as their mother cooked. Joe set up a table outside where they could eat in the fresh air. Ralph arrived promptly in his fancy hat and tie, with Shirley on his arm. She was wearing a dark green dress that fit her perfectly. A small black hat and big, smooth curls framed her face. Becky and Ellie peered out from the doorway at her. "On outside, girls, and say hello." Ellie jumped down the steps and put her hand out toward Shirley.
"Hi, I'm Ellie."
Shirley shook Ellie's bare hand and her delicate, gloved one. "Hi, Ellie. Nice to meet you." Becky stood behind her big sister, shy.
"This is Becky," Ellie said for her.
"Say hello, Becky," urged Joe.
Becky silently stared up at Shirley.
"Hi, Becky. My name's Shirley."
Becky glanced up at her sister, then cautiously smiled.
"Come on over and have a seat."
Joe motioned to the makeshift table he'd constructed from some spare boards left over from Hutman construction. Somehow Shirley looked elegant, even in this ridiculous setting, smoothing her skirt as she sat at the rickety table.
"Ellie, fetch some water for our guests."
Mariah leaned out the doorway. Ralph stood politely, as he always did around her.
"Hello, Mrs. Mariah."
"Hi there, Ralph.
What do you think of our new house?"
Ralph looked around at the dusty jumble of Hutmans and shook his head.
"All I can say is, at least you're together as a family."
"Thank God for that," added Joe.
Ralph motioned to Shirley, who was still seated.
"This here's Shirley Crawford, from Atlanta, Georgia."
Mariah stepped out of the Hutman, followed closely by Ben.
"Hi, Shirley. I'm Mariah."
Shirley extended her hand. Mariah shook it and turned back to the Hutman.
"I'd better finish getting supper ready."
Ellie returned with glasses of water.
"What's Atlanta like?"
she asked as she set the glasses in front of Ralph and Shirley.
"It's nice. A real big city. We've got streetcars and new buildings going up all the time."
"Sounds like Oak Ridge," said Joe.
"It's nothing like Oak Ridge. Atlanta's a real proper city with all sorts of people in it."
"How you like Oak Ridge, Ellie?" asked Ralph.
Ellie shrugged.
"There's lots to see, but Daddy won't let us leave the Hutmans."
"Your daddy just wants you to be safe," said Ralph. "This ain't like living in the country."
"Ain't that the truth?"
Mariah came back out carrying a steaming pot. Joe called the children to the table, and they all joined hands to pray. Mariah began serving stew out, while Ellie passed around peas and potatoes.
"How are you finding it here, Mariah?" asked Ralph.
"I miss the farm.
Only place I ever lived. But I'm glad to be making money, and I'd have moved just about anywhere to have my family all together again."
Mariah spoke sincerely. Her face was thinner than when Joe had left her in Alabama, with a few new lines around her mouth and eyes. She looked tired most of the time. Joe knew living here wasn't easy for her, and living without him in Alabama hadn't been either.
"I'm glad you're here," said Ralph. "I'm real glad you all get to live together. But I'm ashamed it has to be like this, in these here Hutmans."
Becky and Ellie could hear the anger in Ralph's tone. They watched the adults attentively to see what would happen next.
"It's a roof over our heads, and we're all together. That's what matters."
Mariah smiled and instantly looked young again.
"You are too accepting," said Shirley.
The girl's eyes were glued on her now. Do you know that the army actually planned to build slums here? Can you imagine that? When else in history have people created slums on purpose?
I ain't thought of it that way, said Mariah.
Ralph turned to Ellie.
You've still got your harmonica?
Ellie beamed.
Yes. Mama, can I play a song?
After we're through with supper.
She shook her head. This girl loves music.
I can dance,
Becky chimed in. Ralph sat back in his chair.
Well, I think after dinner we'll just have to have a little concert.
You'll have to sing for us, Ralph, said Mariah.
You got about the nicest voice I've ever heard.
Thank you, Mrs. Mariah. If Ellie will play her harmonica, I'll surely sing.
Ellie was good at squawking out melodies, and Ralph kept his word and sang along. The girls attempted to tap dance less successfully, but Joe clapped and cheered for them all the same. They could do so many things they couldn't when he left them to come up here. Later, when Ralph and Shirley had gone and the children were in bed, Joe found Mariah outside at the sink, washing the dishes. He took the rags she'd slung over her shoulder and began drying them.
That girl sure has a lot of opinions, she said.
Shirley?
Mm-hmm,
Mariah mocked.
Shirley Crawford of Atlanta, Georgia.
She's a real city girl.
She's a real know-it-all, if you ask me.
Ralph's crazy for her.
Well, she's good-looking, I'll say that much.
Is she? I hadn't noticed.
Joe grinned at his wife, who put down the dish she was holding. He leaned over and kissed her on the mouth.
You're the most beautiful woman I know.
I know that ain't true, but I like to hear you say it.
Unlike Ralph and Shirley, Joe didn't feel too much like complaining. For the first time in his life, he wasn't working out in the sun. He was in charge of cleaning two corridors of the factory building. He pushed the large flat broom down the hallway and thought it was just in time, too. His knees ached when he walked up the stairs and his back ached all the time. The scrawny secretary who worked for Dr. Cantor walked past and smiled.
Hi, Joe.
Hello, Miss Walker. Don't tell me Dr. Cantor's got you working this late.
I'm just finishing up a couple of things for him.
Well, you'd better hurry on up and get out of this place. He had a beautiful summer night. You go on and enjoy it.
I will. Good night, Joe.
She went into Dr. Cantor's office and shut the door behind her. Joe continued down the hallway. He'd have to remember to come back to the office later. For now, he had the ladies' restroom to deal with. He whistled louder now, his tune echoing in the small, tiled room. June found that not only was she a good typist, she also had a knack for organization. Each evening, Sam would leave an explosion of papers and trash on his desk, and then in the morning, June would set about arranging it into neat, labeled piles. Her own desk was tidy, with a calendar on one side where she kept her running to-do list, and orderly piles along the other end. She would go over her to-do list for the day, make coffee for herself and Sam, and prioritize the day's tasks. By the time Sam got there, she was already hard at work. In the first weeks on the job, it became obvious that June needed to learn dictation. Sam was kind about her ineptitude, of course, but she realized she couldn't hold this position without learning the skills required. She found a guide at the small library, and after some careful observation of the other secretaries on the floor, determined that Sophie, a sweet, chubby girl from Ohio, would be understanding if she asked for help. Sophie met with her at lunch a few times and helped June practice dictation until she had the confidence to follow Sam around, jotting down his words just like a proper secretary. Sam was less happy with his new position. The army required large amounts of paperwork, and he missed his laboratory. Often he told June that he didn't know what he'd do if she weren't there with him. Lose his mind, probably. It made her glad that he appreciated her presence, but she worried about him. She was so much happier as a secretary and hated that he had to be so miserable, as though her happiness had been traded for his. His bad moods made her anxious. She worried about him, but worried, too, that he might take out his frustration on her. And she couldn't help but wonder why she wasn't enough to satisfy him anymore. Today, though, she could see that Sam was excited. His old boss from California, Ernest Lawrence, was visiting. Sam's usual cynicism had dropped away, and he seemed genuinely eager to impress Lawrence. June thought it was sweet.
As best she could tell, Y-12 was running smoothly these days, so hopefully Lawrence would be pleased with Sam's work. Officially, she was not supposed to know about Lawrence's visit. She had to follow all sorts of special protocol to maintain secrecy. Many of the letters and memos she typed were coded so that she didn't actually know what they meant. Sam assured her that it was nothing worth knowing, just dull administrative matters. Classified letters had to be sealed in double envelopes with a sealing wax that would make tampering evident. She also had a special wastebasket for any secret information. Every time she picked up the heavy black phone, a red insert was revealed on the base, which reminded her to avoid loose talk. In truth, she and Sam barely spoke about the war these days. They had all but exhausted the subject of atomic bombs. Now that they worked together, when it was time to go home, all they really wanted to do was leave the office behind, go to the movies, listen to the radio, discuss anything besides Y-12. It was the middle of summer, and June's windowless office was already stuffy when she arrived in the morning. By the afternoon, the air became muggy and oppressive. She inched the small electric fan on her desk closer and closer to her face, forced to use spare change and heavy pens as paperweights for whatever might be in the path of its breeze. The dorm was miserable, too, and never seemed to cool down at night. She had taken to wearing her lightest slip to bed and using only a sheet, her feet sticking out from under it. Still, she would wake in the middle of the night, sweating, her feet throbbing in the heat. The absolute worst place to be on a summer afternoon was on one of the buses. If folks opened the windows, dust came blowing in. If they didn't open them, the bus was suffocating. The still air smelled of sweat, and when the buses were crowded, which was always the case at shift changes, you had to sit or stand uncomfortably close to other damp, sticky bodies. This was one reason that June had taken to staying late at work with Sam. She was supposed to clock out at 5, but if Sam wrote a request for her to stay late, she could present it at the clock alley. They tried to avoid the rush on the buses and the busiest times at the cafeteria. Sam genuinely did need to stay late most days. He never seemed to get a handle on all the forms he had to fill out, letters that had to be signed. Often he got distracted in the afternoons, wandering back to his old lab to see how things were going there. June's work was almost always finished by 5, but she didn't mind staying to keep him company. If she did leave without him, it was usually to go to the movies by herself, a time alone in the dark that she cherished. Sam didn't care for the pictures the way she did, and she didn't need him sitting beside her to enjoy the stories on the screen. She'd slowly been improving her wardrobe, making little purchases from Miller's, new boots here, a jacket and scarf there, in an effort to look smarter, less like a country girl. Now that she was a secretary, this seemed even more urgent. She wanted to dress the part. But it was difficult in this heat to get excited about putting on any clothes. Even lipstick and rouge felt hot on her face. 2 simple cotton dresses she'd made herself were the coolest thing she owned, and she wore them as much as possible. Stockings were hard to come by these days, so luckily she didn't stand out by not wearing them. She'd bought a satin slip, telling herself a working woman needed proper undergarments in addition to the more noticeable accessories. One day when Cece was at work, June tried it on in front of their small mirror. She had never dared look at herself naked before. Sometimes she felt wicked to have let Sam make love to her. With Ronnie, she had felt obligated, but with Sam, she had no real excuse. She figured he didn't know, but she was always nervous when they managed to get the house to themselves. He would expect her to give in to him, and she could hardly tell him no now. Sometimes she didn't know how to react to him, if she was holding her body in the right position, what sound she was supposed to make. Even when she felt pleasure, it was usually eclipsed by her anxiety. Still, she loved how Sam looked at her when she was naked. She never knew she could have that effect on a man. Slowly, she'd drawn her hand across her belly, the fabric deliciously smooth, her skin hot underneath. She was wearing the slip that day in the office as well. It swished against her legs when she walked, and her every step felt sophisticated. She got a call from the front security checkpoint announcing Mr. Lawson's arrival. Lawson was a code name for Lawrence. A few minutes later, she let in Dr. Armstrong and Mr. Lawson, a tall man with glasses. She was surprised by how youthful and athletic he looked, not at all what she'd expected. In Sam's office, the men were all smiles and vigorous handshakes, jolly in one another's presence, and she closed the door on them. A few minutes later, they emerged, and Sam told her not to expect him back in the office until after lunch. One problem with being good at organization and prioritizing was that by midday, she'd often run out of things to do. Sometimes she would type things just for herself, almost to herself, like a journal. Most of the time, she ripped them up when she was done, but every once in a while she'd fold them and put them in her purse. Today she wrote, "Bored? Bored. But why should I be bored? I can do anything I want, really." Hope S. becomes happy. Does my happiness depend on his happiness? Is that good or bad? It would make him angry if I said that. He doesn't like to think I'm too dependent, but if you love someone, how can you be happy if they are not? Truly, completely happy anyway. She stopped typing, stood up, and paced across the room. She had a novel in her purse for reading on the bus, but it seemed too blatantly recreational to take it out here. Strange that she should be paid more money now to do less work. She went back to the typewriter, deciding she would use the time to write her parents another letter. They were so impressed by her typing. Sam didn't get back until after 5 o'clock. By that point, June had given up all pretense of work and was reading the book. As he opened the door, she tossed it into her open pocketbook on the floor. Not that Sam would really mind, yet she still felt guilty. But he didn't notice at all. He had a goofy smile, and she wondered if he was drunk. He closed the door behind him and grinned at her. "I did well today." "Good," she said, standing, genuinely pleased. He came to her and put his arms around her waist. "Lawrence was very happy. He wants to get dinner tonight. Is that all right? I know we had plans."
"It's fine. I've been wanting to go to the movies anyway."
He patted her bottom and went toward his own office. "Thanks, honey. I'll make it up to you. We'll go out tomorrow. I almost forgot. I actually have some work for you to do and need you to stay late tonight. You might still have time for the movie, though."
"Sure. If not, I can catch it another time."
He stopped in the doorway and turned back. "Thank you, June. I really don't know what I'd do without you." He held her gaze for an extended moment, his eyes shining with gratitude and affection. She felt her cheeks already rosy from the heat, redden even more. He still had the power to look at her and make her feel like an altogether more capable, exciting, better person than she had ever felt herself to be before. One look like that and 100 petty grievances and worries would disappear. And maybe this approval from Lawrence was what he needed to cheer him up. Once he was gone, she got to work on the letters he'd left behind for her, and the time went by quickly. The hallways became quieter and quieter as everyone left for the day, until the only sound was the rhythmic clatter of her typewriter.
Chapter 17. Tom was never late. In fact, he made a habit of arriving early wherever he went, which sometimes irritated Cece when she was running behind herself, taking an extra 5 minutes to do her hair, knowing he was waiting for her outside the dorm. Cece glanced at her watch again. 10 minutes late. She sat on a bench by the entrance to the rec center, dabbing at her face with a handkerchief to try and hide her perspiration. She wasn't worried. With another guy, she might have wondered if he was losing interest or stepping out on her. But Tom was devoted. He had written to his mother about Cece, and Mrs. Wolcott had actually sent Cece a letter. She had read it dozens of times. Everything about it was elegant. The return address was stamped on the flap of the envelope. Mrs. Wolcott's penmanship was excellent, and even the paper was softer, smoother than normal. The letter was short and formal, but kind. "Dear Cecilia, it is unfortunate that due to the circumstances of this terrible war, we cannot meet at the present time, except via correspondence. I look forward to the happy day when you can travel with Tom to New Jersey and be introduced to our family in person. Since he was a boy, Tom has been an excellent judge of character, so I trust him when he tells me you are a young woman of superlative character and innumerable charms. A mother cannot help but have strong opinions on the type of woman her son should marry. Having no daughters of my own, perhaps I feel this even more strongly than most. If his accounting is true, Tom would be lucky to have a girl like you by his side. The Wolcotts are a welcoming family. I can assure you, life amongst them is exceedingly comfortable, though not without its responsibilities. I hope you will accept my guidance, should you become a member. With warmest regards, Eleanor Wolcott." Cece had to go to the library to look up superlative and innumerable in the dictionary. It was as though one of the fancy Nashville ladies she used to greet as a hostess had written her a letter and was, in fact, inviting Cece to join her family. This had always been her objective, yet Cece could hardly believe she was this close to crossing the finish line. She looked around, idly. Out of habit, she found herself assessing the array of soldiers on hand. None were intriguing. Not that she was tempted to step out on Tom, anyway. Things had progressed past the point of creating any useful jealousy. The key, now, was merely to keep steady, on course. She saw June and Dr. Cantor coming through the entrance. What a nuisance to have to make small talk with them. June had been a fine girl, but she had changed around that awful scientist, smiling up at him constantly, seeking his approval. Cece had never fawned over a man that way. And June was putting on airs, not the useful kind that Cece had cultivated in herself, but foolish pretensions. She talked about the news and the war with this knowledgeable air that Cece knew was fake.
Hi, Cece. Meeting Tom?
Mm-hmm. You two have fun.
Luckily, they went on past her without any further conversation. She knew Dr. Cantor didn't like her, though Cece couldn't care less about his opinion. He'd gotten June a job as his secretary, which was infuriating. Cece had thought about reporting their relationship to the army. The trouble was she couldn't prove they were doing anything against the rules, even if it was tacky for Dr. Cantor to get his girlfriend promoted. Now June wore suits and only had to work day shifts. Not that Cece particularly wanted to be a secretary. That was short-term thinking. She was going to be a wife. She saw Tom walking toward her on the boardwalk before he noticed her. His head was down, and he was walking fast, distracted. She waved, but he didn't see until he was standing practically in front of her. He looked at her with an expression she'd never quite seen on him, his brow creased, mouth clenched. "What's wrong?" asked Cece.
"I've had a letter from Bobby," said Tom. Cece had heard all about Bobby, Tom's best childhood friend who was in the Navy.
"What did he say?"
"He's been injured."
Tom didn't elaborate.
"How serious is it?"
"He's been in the hospital for weeks. He was burned."
Cece began to understand the look on Tom's face. She put her hand on his.
"I'm so sorry, Tom."
"His face is burned. Can you imagine?"
Cece shook her head. Tom looked close to crying.
"Poor Bobby," he said. "He'll never look normal again."
"We don't have to go inside. Do you want to go home?"
Tom stared at the ground and said nothing. Cece watched him, unsure of what to do next. She usually knew just what to say to a man, but then again, men were usually happy around her. After a long silence, Tom seemed to become energized and grabbed Cece's hands. He looked her in the eye and began speaking quickly, as though in a rush to get his thoughts out. "Let's get married, Cece. I'm sorry, I know this isn't how I should propose. I promise when the war is over, I'll get you a proper ring and a white dress, too, if you want. But let's get married now. Right now. I don't want to wait any longer. Will you say yes? Will you marry me?" Cece was shocked. She had never known Tom to be impulsive. She was about to get everything she wanted, and the feeling was almost too much for her to bear.
"Of course I want to marry you. But we can't even live together."
I know. But listen, if anything happens to me..."
"What would happen to you? You're perfectly safe here."
"If I get sent to Japan, when we invade."
"You think that will happen?"
"I don't know."
Cece thought of the letter from Mrs. Walcott and squeezed Tom's hands.
"I'll marry you, Tom. But you should tell your family first. I don't want to go behind their back or get off on the wrong foot."
Tom's shoulders dropped as though relieved.
"You're right, of course. I'll write to your aunt as well, and to ask her permission."
Cece dreaded forging a reply to Tom from her mythical aunt, but at least she had Mrs. Walcott's letter to guide her now.
"That would mean a lot, dear Aunt Fay."
"I love you, Cece."
He kissed her fiercely, and the pressure of his mouth on hers made Cece feel like she couldn't breathe. When he finally pulled away, she put a hand to his cheek.
I love you, too.
It was the first time in her life she had said those words. Her family had never been given to emotional declarations, and they felt ill-suited to her mouth. Tom gave her a squeeze.
Cece Wolcott, how does that sound?
It sounds wonderful. They went to the canteen and the roller rink, Tom telling everyone they saw along the way that they were engaged. His mood had completely transformed. Bobby was forgotten, and he wanted to celebrate. Finally, she had to send him off to bed, but not before a long session of necking on the boardwalk, more than she'd ever let him get away with before. She went straight to bed when she got to the dorm. They'd stayed out too late, and she was exhausted. Still, she found she was unable to sleep. She had done it. He would marry her tomorrow, if she said the word. It was everything she wanted. Her future was secure. There would be no hunger, no hand-me-down dresses, no tobacco harvesting, no Baptist preachers. Yet, she didn't feel quite happy. Success was unsettling. She had expected something more, something deep and satisfying. Instead, she felt empty. For so long, she had devoted all her energy to achieving this goal, and she hadn't the faintest idea how she would occupy herself now. It was Sam's idea that they go on a real trip together. They could only get one day off from work, so they couldn't go far, but he'd heard colleagues talk about going to Gatlinburg for the weekend, a little town on the edge of the new Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Anne and Charlie had gone themselves a couple of months earlier and recommended a hotel. Sam made all the arrangements and told June all she had to do was meet him at the bus depot Friday morning with a suitcase. He'd put it in romantic terms, saying it would be a chance for them to have some time to themselves, not at Y-12, but in a lovely mountain chalet next to a burbling brook. Still, June knew there was more to Sam's urgency than he was letting on, and suspected his main motivation was to get her into bed. He was always coming up with strategies for getting her over to the house when Charlie and Anne were out. The night before the trip, however, her monthly period came. She didn't know how to tell Sam. It was all she could think about that morning, waiting at the depot, her abdomen knotted in pain. It was a hot, hazy day already at 8 o'clock, and she wanted to find a seat on the bus, hopefully by a window. "Hello, gorgeous," said Sam, putting an arm around her.
"Ready for our adventure?" she asked, and he nodded.
At least he seemed happy. Lawrence's visit had cheered him briefly, but as soon as the physicist left town, Sam's mood had turned sour. It was obvious he didn't like his new job. He was irritable and short-tempered, snapping at June over the smallest things. He was also drinking more, and she was no longer able to distract him from his whiskey. They had to take one bus to Knoxville and then transfer to another that would take them the 80 miles to Gatlinburg. June leaned on Sam's shoulder when they sat down.
"You all right?"
he asked.
"Mm-hmm. Just sleepy."
The perfect opening for her to tell him, but she couldn't. They had time to kill in Knoxville, and Sam suggested a big breakfast at the bus stop diner. June ordered scrambled eggs and toast.
"Come on, is that all you want? It's my treat. Sausage, pancakes."
He was in such a jaunty holiday mood that she hated to disappoint him.
"I'm just not that hungry,"
she smiled weakly. The bus to Gatlinburg was only about half full, and they sat in the back, away from the other passengers. He put his arm around her and whispered in her ear,
"Do you know what I'm going to do first thing when we get to the hotel?" She didn't want to hear about it.
"Why don't you wait and tell me about it when we get there?"
He leaned back into the seat to doze. She looked out the window as they crossed the Tennessee River. Two men were fishing off the side of a boat. It would be nice to be down there, able to jump right in the river for a swim, about the only way a person could cool down these days. Soon the buildings of the city gave way to farmland, and then a mountain rose up in the distance. The bus stopped in Sevierville, where the driver pointed out the historic courthouse with a tall clock tower in the middle of town. The majestic Mount LeConte loomed in the distance, its muted blue standing out against the hazy summer sky. Gatlinburg was hardly more than a village, populated with a few new inns and restaurants meant to cater to national park visitors. The park had been completed less than a decade earlier, and parts of it came over into Blount County, not that far from where June grew up. It had been another government project that forced people out of their homes, but June liked the idea of it better than that of a dam or bomb-building factory. The land had to be kept exactly as it was to be a gift to future generations. It was a comfort to know there were still places that no one could touch. Their hotel overlooked the Little Pigeon River, and though the room was furnished simply, it did have a balcony with two rocking chairs where you could sit and watch the water burble by. Sam seemed satisfied by it, and as soon as they had a look around, he tossed June on the bed. She had to speak now. "Honey," his eyes were closed and he was kissing her neck, working his hands up her thigh. He paid no attention to her voice. "Honey, I have to tell you something." His hands were on her breast, his mouth approaching her lips. "Sam!" She had his attention, and he opened his eyes. She swallowed.
"I have bad news."
"What?"
"My monthly period started last night."
He sat up straight. Do you not feel up to it?
I don't know. Does it bother you?"
"Not if it doesn't bother you." He began kissing her neck again. But the further his lovemaking progressed, the more she realized it did bother her. When his hand tried to make its way between her legs, her muscles clenched almost involuntarily. She felt awkward and dirty.
"I don't want to ruin the sheets," she said.
"I'll get a towel." He went into the bathroom and returned with one, a pristine white.
"It'll ruin the towel."
He tossed it on the bed. "What if we do it in the bath?"
"In the bath?"
June wasn't sure exactly how that would work. "Sure, it'll be fun." Her flesh pressed into hard porcelain, horribly self-conscious about the blood. June was sure that their romantic weekend was off to an inauspicious start. They ate lunch at a nearby diner, both too embarrassed to make much conversation. June wondered if he was disgusted by her. As they finished their sandwiches, the afternoon loomed in front of them like a threat. June suggested they walk to the national park. They walked in silence through the town, both lost in thought. June wondered what was going through his mind. She wanted the weekend to be good, wanted to think of some way to salvage it. She picked black-eyed Susans from along the side of the road as they walked, making a bouquet.
"We should look for a nicer place to get supper tonight," she said.
Sam nodded. There was a small visitor center at the entrance to the park, and they browsed separately. June was relieved to have a few moments to herself, away from the oppressive silence that had dogged them ever since they left the hotel. It was already getting to be late afternoon, and when they got back to the hotel, she suggested a nap. They lay next to each other on the bed, fully clothed. But June wasn't able to sleep. She knew this wasn't what Sam had planned, and wished she could will her body to cooperate. She got up off the bed, deciding to take a bath instead. She ran cool water into the tub and dropped her hot body into it, savoring the chill it brought to her skin. When she got out, she put on her favorite summer dress, a delicate pink with a full skirt and little sleeves that just skimmed her shoulders. She filled a coffee cup with water and put the black-eyed Susans in it on the dresser.
"How do you like Gatlinburg?"
she asked that night over their respective chicken and pork chop. She was determined to sustain a conversation.
"Not much of a town, but the mountains are beautiful."
"I've never been here before. Funny, 'cause I grew up so close. I'm glad they built the national park."
"It looks lovely. It'd be nice to see more of it."
The discussion continued along those lines. It was as if they had run out of things to say to each other. When they were done, they trudged back to the hotel room, and Sam took a bottle of Splo from a suitcase and went out to the balcony. She was fairly certain he'd already been into it before supper as well. She didn't like it. It hurt her that he needed to drink that awful stuff, even on their romantic weekend. Why was she no longer enough to make him happy? She wanted to say something, but knew if she did, it would probably cause trouble. Idly, she picked up one of the flowers from her bouquet and began ripping off the petals. "He loves me. He loves me not." She felt she knew the answer without having to rely on a flower to tell her so. For a moment, she watched him. He was standing by the rail, looking down at the small river. She went out and stood beside him. He offered her the bottle, but she shook her head. The dark outline of the mountains was illuminated by an almost full moon.
You shouldn't drink so much, Sam.
Why not? Because it's sinful?
He was laughing at her.
No, because it makes you unhappy.
I'd be unhappy without the liquor. Drinking just makes the unhappiness easier to take.
Is your life really as bad as all that?
She said, accusing.
Don't worry. It's not your fault, June.
She didn't know what to say to him and tried to think of a way to change the subject, soften the mood.
Daddy always says you can see God in the mountains.
Immediately she regretted saying this, knowing Sam would think that sort of thing was silly. He didn't laugh, but replied,
"They're big and beautiful, but I don't see God in them."
Well, it's an idea, you know. You're not really supposed to see him, I suppose.
I get it.
It was hard to get a good look at his face in the darkness, but his voice sounded mean.
I think because the mountains are beautiful, you're supposed to see God in them.
I get it, but I don't see God.
Don't you have the same God?
She asked, hoping he didn't find the question stupid. He took a big gulp of the splo.
Do you mean do Jews have the same God as you Christians do?
Yes, I guess.
I guess as a Christian you'd see it that way.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean any offense.
None taken. But if you want to discuss theology, you've got the wrong man.
What do you mean?
I don't believe any of it. I'm only a Jew because my parents were Jews. I don't have a God.
You mean you don't believe?
Believe in what?
God.
He took another drink and looked away.
What God? What God do you think there is in this world? My whole family in Europe is dead.
He turned to her, his voice rising, and she took a step back.
Dead? Aunts, uncles, cousins, dozens of human beings. All over Europe, a generation disappeared. Do you know how many dead? How many in Russia or China?
She was shaking her head, but he paid no attention.
Not just dead, he ranted. Tortured and raped as well. Do you know how many we've killed with our bombs in Dresden and Tokyo? And how many thousands more will die when this bomb that we, you and I, work on every day is finished? It will kill indiscriminately babies, mothers, the elderly, whatever is in its path. What God is there in this world? Where do you see God?
Sam had never spoken to her like this. He seemed off-kilter, capable of anything, cruelty, violence, even.
Why are you shouting at me? I didn't mean to make you angry.
Just shut up, then. Stop rambling on about God like a country hick.
Why would you call me that?
I don't know, June. Because I'm not nice. I told you the first time we met, but you didn't listen.
Why are you acting this way?
Christ, I just told you I am a bad man. I'm not nice.
Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
I'm going out,
he said, grabbing his hat and taking the bottle with him out the door. She stumbled back into the room to the bed and lay there in her dress, crying until she fell asleep. Sam didn't come in until around 4 o'clock, and he passed out in the bed almost immediately, snoring drunkenly. He was still deeply asleep when June awoke the next morning. She went out to the balcony and closed the door behind her. She watched the clear water form white lines as it passed over rocks. If she stared at it long enough, it looked still, even though it was rushing past.
I should leave him, she thought.
This wasn't right. She shouldn't be in a hotel with a man she wasn't married to. Especially a man who drank like that. He shouldn't drink like that. He shouldn't speak to her that way. But she couldn't imagine her life without him. If only she could help him. Not that long ago, she thought she had. He'd stopped drinking during their first months together. During the winter and spring, they had done everything together, in sync, happy together. He'd often told her that she made his life better. But he never said that anymore. She didn't know what had changed or what she could do to give back to those times. She'd been sitting like that for a long time, when Sam opened the door and walked out beside her.
June.
His voice was soft and faltering, so different from last night.